Over the course of 4 days in November 1989, Jason Carroll and Tony Puff had managed to fully implicate themselves in the murder of Sharon Johnson. Notwithstanding the many inconsistencies and even impossibilities of their statements, it was enough to lay the groundwork to arrest Jason, Tony, and yes, finally even Ken. Now, if the tape confessions themselves were painful to listen to, remember this. We didn't even get to hear how the sausage was made. We only have glimpses of the hours and hours of non-recorded interrogation that took place both before and after the tape confessions. And those glimpses aren't pretty. For example, shortly after Tony Puff caved and gave his statement on the night of November 27th, he added another detail. That Lisa Johnson, Ken Johnson's adopted daughter, was not only involved in Sharon's murder, but she was also present at the murder scene because she wanted to see her stepmom get killed. Of course, the reality was that Lisa was hours away in Rhode Island when Sharon was killed, so none of that could have been true. Tony also added that Ken himself had met Jason and Tony at the mall when they nabbed Sharon, and that they had followed Ken to the construction site. Ken was apparently driving a blue car, said Tony, but it wasn't Ken's own Subaru. 10 minutes later, Tony told the investigators that it was all a lie, every bit of it, that his entire statement was false, that he had nothing to do with the crime, and that he had not even moved Sharon's car like he had said earlier in the year. Half an hour later, Tony recanted his recantation and once again accepted responsibility for taking part in Sharon's murder. Clearly, things were not as neatly tied in a bow as the investigators may have wanted, which is why the investigation didn't end there. Detective Sergeant Roland Lammy kept going, kept looking for more evidence, for more witnesses, for anything to corroborate Jason and Tony's statements. But it's fair to say, very little went according to plan. Welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 8 of our series on the state versus Jason Carroll. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. On Tuesday, November 28, 1989, Sergeants Lammy and Scott, accompanied by three other officers, traveled to Rhode Island to extradite and charge Ken Johnson with capital murder. When they arrived, Ken had already been placed under arrest as a fugitive from justice. Sergeants Lammy and Scott found Ken in an interview room at the Warren, Rhode Island Police Department, and while Ken agreed to listen to them, his attorney had told him not to answer any questions. And so Ken listened as the officers told him they had with them a person who could one day testify in court against him, and that this person was willing to repeat to Ken everything he'd already told the police. They then led Jason Carroll into the room. Jason had agreed to come to Rhode Island to confront Ken as part of the police's plan to get Ken to crumble and confess. Jason began reciting his statement to Ken and got as far as getting to the construction site and seeing Ken there. That's when Ken threw up his arms in the air, disgusted, and told the officers to get Jason out of his sight. Lammy and Scott hustled Jason out of the room, and that was the last time the two co-defendants came face to face. Later on the same day, Ken waived the extradition, handed himself over to Sergeant Lammy, and was driven back to New Hampshire to face charges. And with that, the news of the three arrests made every paper in the region, and suddenly sparked the memories of people who thought they had vital information about the murder. The day after Ken's arrest, Bedford Police Chief David Bailey got a strange call from Charles Goodwin, the owner of Goodwin's funeral home, the funeral home where Sharon Johnson's wake and burial were held. Goodwin reported that on the day of Sharon's funeral, the family members were the last ones to be in the presence of the casket before it was finally sealed. Ken was there next to the casket and didn't realize that he wasn't alone. One of the funeral home employees was in the room and surreptitiously saw Ken remove a sealed envelope from his jacket and place it into the casket. Sergeant Lammy did not take this lead lightly. The next day, he interviewed the funeral home employee, Loretta Aslan, who was the person who had embalmed Sharon's body. It was her job to touch up and rearrange the body every evening after visitors left, because it would often mess up the original presentation. Loretta told Lammy that she noted how weird Ken was acting the entire time. He mostly hung out outside the building while his brother Tom made all the arrangements. One day, however, she remembered Ken and Tom being in the room alone with the body, and then Tom left. That was when she saw Ken take a white envelope out of his jacket and slide it between one of Sharon's arms and her body. He placed the envelope in a way that it was nearly hidden, and no one other than someone handling the body would have seen it, which is why Loretta saw it. That evening, as Loretta fixed Sharon back up, she pulled out the white envelope, which was sealed shut. She remembered the words written on it clearly: "To Sharon, with love, from Ken." Lammy told Loretta that on the day of the funeral, there were a couple of plainclothes police officers already in the room observing the proceedings, and they noted that Kathy Hampson, one of Sharon's closest friends, had read a letter, put it in an envelope, and handed it to Ken, which he then placed in the casket. Could that have been the letter that she saw? "Nope," said Loretta. She wasn't even there the day of the funeral. What she saw had happened the night before. Before the interview ended, Loretta added that Ken Johnson still owed $2,431.82 from the funeral bill. He'd stopped making payments in the bill nearly a year earlier. Scott and Lammy then circled back to Kathy Hampson to confirm the police report that her own letter had been put in the casket, and she said yes. She'd read the letter out during the service and then placed it in the casket. The officers must have believed Loretta's story, though, that this was an entirely different letter, because the next day they applied for a sealed warrant asking for Sharon Johnson's remains to be disinterred and examined.
They got their warrant. On December 13th, 1989, Sharon's body was exhumed in the presence of Lammy, Scott, and funeral home employees, including Loretta. As the officers watched, one of the employees searched the casket and pulled out a sealed white envelope from the left side of the body. It was the only envelope found in the casket, and it had one word written on it: Sharon. Lammy handed the envelope to Loretta and asked if it was the one she'd seen Ken put into the casket. She said it was the right size and shape, but she remembered the envelope being a brighter white and it didn't have the same thing written on it. Despite these discrepancies, Sergeant Lammy believed this envelope fell within the scope of the warrant and seized it to examine the contents. 2 days later, the envelope was opened at the State Police Forensic Lab, and out came a single typewritten page addressed to Sharon from Kathy Hampson. While the contents of the envelope didn't get the investigators any closer to the truth of what happened to Sharon, the affidavit Sergeant Lammy wrote in support of the warrant does give us a glimpse at Lammy's theory of the crime at the time. The affidavit outlined how and when Tony and Jason were solicited, how Sharon was killed, and Ken's role in the entire thing. Significantly, what was missing was this: any mention of the motive behind the crime. And that might be because at some point, after getting Jason to confess that Ken wanted Sharon dead because she caught him raping his daughter, Lammy had a change of heart. It's been confusing, to be honest, as to why someone as competent in sniffing out the truth, according to his colleagues, would be so wedded to a demonstrably false theory. Lammy knew that Tony was the father of Lisa's baby. He knew that there was never any evidence that Ken had sexually assaulted Lisa. But he still believed that was the motive behind the killing, to the extent that he made Jason Carroll repeat the lie. Or did he? Did he really believe it? Or was it just a useful lie to convince Jason to help them get Ken, a man so awful he'd rape his own daughter? It's hard to know what Sergeant Lammy believed, because about a week after the confessions and arrests, Lammy fully briefed a witness he was interviewing and laid out both the facts as he believed them and his theory of the case. He told this witness, "Ken Johnson knew that Sharon was about to divorce him and knew that she was heavily insured. And rather than just let the divorce take place, we feel that he decided to capitalize on the insurance and he met with Tony Puff, a person that we know you know, and he hired Tony Puff for $10,000 to kill Sharon Johnson." Again, he never mentions the rape. That entire storyline has suddenly and strangely vanished. In case you're wondering what happened in this interview, though, the witness gave Lammy some of what he was searching for. More confirmation that Tony was a dirtbag who was throwing a lot of money around late summer of 1988, and who had heard that Tony had bragged about killing someone. But that was it. The witness didn't know who Tony had killed, how he'd committed the murder, how much he'd been paid, or who paid him. And no, she didn't know anyone named Jason Carroll, and Tony had never mentioned such a person around her. This witness was one of many that Lammy continued to seek out to corroborate Tony and Jason's confessions. Interestingly, he was able to identify several people from North Carolina who told him that Tony had confided in them before his arrest, that he was an important witness in a murder case, that he was cooperating with the police, and that he had moved the car of a murdered woman without knowing she'd been murdered, and that the husband of the victim owed money to some dangerous people. None of these people, however, told Lammy that Tony had confessed to being involved in the murder itself. Sergeant Lammy may have made his arrests, but as far as he was concerned, his work was still cut out for him. A December 15, 1989 news article reported Lammy and Scott as being surrounded by congratulatory folks every time he tried to grab a meal. They would try to be polite, but frankly, they were tired of the attention. "For them," said the article, "the arrests were just one step in a long process. They still had loads of work left to do, and Lammy is quoted as saying that he couldn't remember the last time he was this tired." He had good reason to be tired, though, because pretty much every fact that he tried to nail down from the confession turned out to be disproven.
Of great importance to Sergeant Lammy was finding Sharon's missing shirt, the white maternity blouse with teddy bears on it, which he believed that Tony actually took along with him in a greenish-blue duffel bag after killing her. Why Tony would do such a thing, take evidence of the murder with him, is anyone's guess, but Lammy believed it enough to actually try and find it. If what Jason, in one iteration of his confession, said was true, that means Tony left the bag with him, Jason, and Jason dropped it off at Tony's place the night of the murder. Remember, Jason said he handed the bag to a dark-haired woman who answered the door. Now this, if it actually happened, would help the police account for where the bag went. After all, Tony didn't take it with him to work that night, and it wasn't left in Jason's truck. Now at the time of the murder, Tony was living with a woman named Karen Poulin and her husband, and Karen vaguely matched the description that Jason gave. But when investigators followed up with her, she had no idea what they were talking about. She didn't recall Tony ever owning such a bag. And in fact, she told Sergeant Lammy that when Tony moved to North Carolina a few weeks after the murder, she had to lend him a backpack to carry his things. Almost 2 months after the arrest, though, the police spoke to Dwayne Bartlett, the man who worked with Tony on the night of the murder. Dwayne told the police that all of the employees of High Tech Fire Prevention carried extra clothing with them, likely because it was a dirty job, and that he remembered Tony using a small gym bag that was either blue or green to carry his. Of course, this comes months after Jason provided this detail, and nowhere in earlier interviews of Tony's co-workers does anyone mention this. For all we know, Dwayne could have been fed that detail by the investigators. Ultimately, though, investigators never found that bag, and whether or not that bag ever existed is still up in the air. The shirt, however, did exist, and as luck would have it, a few weeks after the arrests, Sergeant Lammy got a tantalizing lead on the shirt. Officer Clayton Bryant of the Wallace, North Carolina Police Department reached out to tell Corporal David Eastman of the New Hampshire State Police that they had a confidential informant with information about the bloody shirt that they were seeking. Bryant hadn't yet seen the shirt himself. He'd only heard about it. The informant that had called him told him that the shirt was light blue, had two California raisins on it, with the writing, "I heard it through the grapevine." When Bryant finally got to examine the shirt, he noticed that the shirt had holes in it that seemed to look like stab marks, and even more importantly, stains that might have been faded blood. Now, despite the fact that this California raisin shirt in no way, shape, or form seemed to be the one that Sharon was wearing on the night she was killed, Corporal Eastman told Bryant that there was a very strong possibility it was the shirt that they were looking for, and he was immediately dispatched to North Carolina to get that shirt. The confidential informant turned out to be a man named Larry Darnell, and he had first heard about the shirt from a woman named Pat English, who had briefly dated Tony when he moved to North Carolina. The investigators were familiar with Pat English. They had interviewed her a few weeks after arresting Tony, but at that time she'd never mentioned the shirt. In fact, apparently Pat English had completely forgotten about the shirt until she went through her closet and found it. And then she confided in Darnell. She was too scared to contact the police herself, and so she gave him the shirt. Darnell felt compelled to tell the police about it, though he was afraid for his life. But the thought of letting a murderer go, however, was just too much to bear for him. Darnell wasn't ready to hand the shirt over immediately, though. Officer Bryant had to play phone tag with Darnell for weeks because Darnell wanted to be connected to the New Hampshire investigators directly, and also because Darnell, who was called the Wizard by his friends, practiced something called parapsychology. He believed he could use his powers to help the investigation. After a couple of meetings with Bryant, though, it was made clear that his psychic gifts were unnecessary, and Darnell finally handed the shirt over. Once again, notwithstanding the fact that nothing about this shirt matched the one that Sharon was wearing on the night she was killed, Corporal Eastman dutifully retrieved what every investigator connected to the case hoped, that this could be the first actual physical evidence that connected Tony Puff to the murder. Of course, it didn't. Even though the shirt was turned over to the New Hampshire State Crime Lab, the evidence examination request form stated to hold off any testing on it. Maybe because once Sergeant Lammy got a look at it, he realized it couldn't be Sharon's shirt. Just like the letter in the casket, the California Raisins shirt turned out to be a useless waste of time and energy. It seemed the arrests were bringing out all kinds of people who thought they could help the detectives, but instead were hindering their case. Not the least of which was a young woman by the name of Debbie Dutra.
My first question for you is, how did you know Jason Carroll?
I met him when I was a teenager.
Okay.
He was going out with my best friend, Leslie, at the time. He hung out with us all the time.
Yeah.
We were always together, all of us. So that's how I met him. And I mean, I think I knew him 2 years before this happened.
On December 19th, 1989, a couple of weeks after the arrests, Debbie was interviewed by investigators and put a big fat hole in the case that no one saw coming. Jason had been seeing her best friend, Leslie Smith, for a couple of years, including up until the time of the murder.
He was dating her still, because we were at his parents, at Leslie's parents' house, the weekend that this happened. So,
yeah.
Which is why I already know he didn't do it. I think his mother botched the whole thing.
Debbie's referring specifically to Saturday, July 30th, 2 days after Sharon was murdered, and the morning that Jason said he and Tony went to Ken's house to get paid. Now, you might recall from the last episode, Jason told Sergeants Lammy and Scott that he didn't remember anything about the house at all or where it was even located. That was because Jason was never there, especially not in that morning. Back in 1989, Debbie hadn't even heard of the murder and knew nothing about the case until Jason was arrested and then prosecutors showed up at her door.
I had no clue. I found out my dad actually worked for the Hillsborough County Superior Court. So when he got arrested, that's how I heard about it. And then the next thing I know, prosecutors are showing up at my mother's door to talk to me.
When Jason was arrested, Debbie's father in particular was highly concerned about her friendship with Jason and whether she had any involvement. She didn't, of course, and she also didn't realize that she had anything relevant to add to the investigation.
They showed up at my mother's My mother and father were there, and they just sat and asked me all sorts of questions. And I think I took it as they were probing me. But the prosecutors, as soon as they heard, I mean, I sat there and I said, he didn't do it. I know he didn't. This weekend, I know where we were. This is where we were. Never heard anything from them again.
There's a very good reason the prosecutors never contacted Debbie again. If what she told them was true, Jason wasn't anywhere near Ken's house on the morning of Saturday, July 30th. Debbie told investigators that she recalled taking a trip, a double date if you will, with herself and her boyfriend Kenneth Goslin and Leslie and her boyfriend Jason Carroll to Weirs Beach in New Hampshire back in July of 1988. She was pretty sure it was the last weekend of July. The report of the interview notes that Debbie also remembered there was nothing unusual or strange about Jason's conduct while they were at the beach, and that he was so broke that he had to borrow 10 bucks from her. This is, of course, a big problem. If the investigators have no evidence other than the confessions, which was exactly where they stood, this information weakened Jason's confession even further. And so they tried to convince Debbie she had her dates wrong. At trial, when Debbie testified for Jason's defense, she told the jury she was pressured repeatedly to say this trip had taken place the following weekend, not the weekend of the murder. Debbie gave in momentarily and told the officers, okay, maybe it was Labor Day weekend, but she knew she could prove that it wasn't. That was because she had kept a diary, and when Jason's lawyer reached out to her, she told him about it.
I had mentioned to him, I'm like, I can prove this. I said, I have a journal. That's how the journal came about. And, you know, I told Eric my biggest concern with it was I didn't want it being publicized. That's like a diary, you know, it's a girl's diary. It had stuff in there I didn't want anyone to know. And he promised me no one would look at it. And he held to that promise. I mean, even the prosecutors didn't read it. I brought it to court. And then we had a third party come and do that for us, which was my mother. My parents had gotten divorced at that time, and their lawyer came and she read it. She was the third party out person. She knew my family history, so I didn't mind her doing it. And then all she had to do was go back in the court and prove and just say, yes, this is in there. This is the date. This is the page. So I still don't understand how he got convicted knowing he was there. He wasn't there.
Debbie's diary confirmed what she had told the investigators, that she, her boyfriend Kenneth, Jason, and Jason's girlfriend Leslie had all spent the weekend of July 30th at Weirs Beach. The diary doesn't say what time they left, but Debbie testified they left early, around 8 or 9 a.m. Kenneth Goslin and Leslie both back up Debbie's recollection and her diary. They had all been together all weekend, which meant there was no way that Jason was with Tony collecting money from Ken on that Saturday morning.
Not much was going in favor of the investigation at this point. No new evidence, nothing yet to connect Jason and Tony to the murder, other than their own statements. Statements which were a big mess and full of impossibilities. The confessions weren't solid by a long shot, yet they were all Sergeant Lammy had. And it seemed he was going to do everything possible to preserve what he could. You might be on the fence about whether Sergeant Lammy crossed the line with the way he obtained the confessions from Jason and Tony, but what he did next after the arrests definitely crossed a line. In his attempt to preserve the confessions, he not only kept meeting with Jason's parents, he also tried his best to interfere in Jason's legal representation and told Jason's parents to report back any information they had about Jason's conversations with his lawyer. This interference actually began in the hours before Jason was arrested. Handwritten notes by Jason's stepfather, John Carroll, state that on the evening of Monday, November 27th, Lammy sat with the family, Jason, Karen, and John, and explained that the immunity offer would look like 20 to life in a federal penitentiary where he would even get an education, and that Jason would get out in 5 to 8 years. Jason would get a court-appointed attorney, Lammy told them, and that it was very important for Jason to keep his mouth shut and let his parents do the talking, so that, quote, better control of the lawyer could be obtained. If an offer of 20 to life with possible parole in 5 to 8 years seems like not such a great immunity offer, that's because it needs to be understood that Jason was not facing a life sentence. He was facing a death sentence. Jason was going to be charged with capital murder, the penalty for which was potentially death. These terms, which Sergeant Lammy would advocate to the Attorney General for, would of course only apply if Jason continued to cooperate. Karen agreed with Lammy that Jason would likely have to get a public defender because they didn't have the money to pay for a private attorney. Lammy asked her if she had any private attorneys in mind, and she brought up Mark Sisti, who had once worked at the public defender's office. By this time, though, Sisti had already achieved national notoriety by representing Pamela Smart, who became a household name in 1991, when she was put on trial for having her husband murdered by her boyfriend. Sergeant Lammy shot down the idea. No, you don't want him, he told the Carrolls. Karen brought up another lawyer, and again, Lammy said no. A few days later, Jason was given a court-appointed attorney. On the weekend before the probable cause hearing, Sergeant Lammy asked the Carrolls to come meet with him. And Karen reported to him that attorneys Stephen Maynard and Cliff Kinghorn had been appointed as Jason's counsel. During the meeting, Lammy instructed the Carrolls to contact the new attorneys as soon as possible and to tell them that Jason's confession was given with no promises or threats or coercion. Lammy also told them to tell the lawyer that Jason was going to testify at the grand jury hearing in exchange for possibly a lesser charge like manslaughter. 2 days later, Karen met with attorney Kinghorn and did exactly that. It did not go well. She told Kinghorn that Jason was going to cooperate with the state and that Kinghorn's job was to get her son 20 to life in a federal pen. She did not, of course, tell the attorney that Lammy had directed her to say these things. Kinghorn responded by challenging her, asking her how she could have let Jason spill his guts to the police without an attorney. When Karen and John realized this lawyer was not going to play ball, they left upset. The Carrolls next saw Sergeant Lammy on the morning of the probable cause hearing and told him that Kinghorn was an asshole and that they were not going to be able to control him. She also told Lammy that Kinghorn informed them that they were not going to get any information about the case from him or his office, and that he had instructed Jason not to give them any information either. Lammy told them that they needed to get Jason another lawyer. In the meantime, Lammy couldn't contact Jason because he was lawyered up, but Jason was always free to call Lammy himself. Jason didn't call Lammy, of course. And he stopped telling his mother everything he was discussing with his attorney. This hurt Karen, but more importantly, it scared her. She trusted that Sergeant Lammy was going to be able to get her son immunity and save him from the death penalty. And now Jason was stuck with a lawyer who wouldn't let him cooperate and was effectively throwing away the chance for a deal.
Lammy saw the writing on the wall, and he knew that the first move Jason's attorney was going to make was to suppress Jason's confession. You remember Trooper Thomas Sexton saying in a previous episode that many of the confessions Sergeant Lammy obtained did get thrown out in suppression hearings, so clearly Lammy knew he had to prepare for the possibility. A week after the probable cause hearing, Lammy called Jason's parents back into a meeting with him and Sergeant Scott. Together, they created a chronology of events leading from Jason's first confession to his arrest. Lammy told the Carrolls they had to get this airtight because the defense would hammer away at him when they got to trial. They spent hours together pulling together the chronology, and parts of the meeting were recorded, including a part in which Sergeant Lammy asked Karen if any threats or promises had been made to Jason in exchange for his confession. Karen responded on tape, "No, there had not." She was then asked if Jason had been coerced into the confession. And again on tape, Karen said no, he was not. On the stand a couple of years later, though, Karen said she lied on the tape. She lied because she trusted Sergeant Lammy, because he was a colleague in the force, and because he held the power to prevent her son from getting the death penalty. The grand jury hearing was scheduled for January of 1990, and Jason was confused and conflicted leading up to it. He didn't know if he should listen to his attorneys or to his mother, who kept insisting to him that he would only be safe if he cooperated with the police. Of course, his lawyers wouldn't let him cooperate. But Karen had an idea to circumvent his lawyers by writing a letter directly to the Attorney General. And so Jason did. Karen dictated a 2-page letter over the phone to Jason, which stated that Jason wanted to cooperate with the state and that his lawyers wouldn't let him. Jason wrote and signed the letter and then sent it to his mother through a person she knew who worked at the jail. As soon as Karen got the letter, she called Sergeant Lammy and told him it was in her possession. Lammy asked to meet with her before she delivered the letter to the Attorney General, and so the next day they did, at a diner. Lammy again stressed to her the importance of Jason's cooperation in getting a reduced sentence. And then together they went to the AG's office and met with the lead prosecutor in a conference room to hand the letter over. It was a short meeting, less than 15 minutes long, and at no point did the prosecutor bring up immunity for Jason. But that didn't bother Karen, because again, she trusted Roland Lammy when he told her he was negotiating the matter with the AG's office. As for the letter, well, the prosecutors understood better than Sergeant Lammy and Karen that there was nothing they could do with it. They couldn't reach out to Jason because he was represented, and they certainly could not interfere in an attorney-client relationship. Jason could fire his lawyers if he wanted to, but the Attorney General couldn't replace his lawyers if they weren't letting him turn state's witness. In the end, despite Sergeant Lammy's attempts to wrangle Jason and his lawyers into cooperating, it didn't happen. And Jason neither fired his lawyers nor were they otherwise replaced. His lawyers did what they were supposed to do. They shielded Jason from the investigators, prosecutors, and his own parents. They were going to fight this prosecution tooth and nail, and fight the legitimacy of the confession itself. Jason's attorneys might have cut his parents off, but Lammy still stayed in frequent contact with them, at least until the grand jury proceedings, in which all three men were indicted. Jason was indicted on 2 counts of capital murder, one for killing Sharon Johnson after being solicited, and the second for killing her after kidnapping her. Tony was indicted on the same 2 counts and an additional count for soliciting Jason, and both Jason and Tony were additionally indicted on first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and kidnapping. Ken, ironically, faced less counts than the two others. He was indicted on 3 counts, including solicitation to kill, conspiracy to commit murder, and accomplice to first-degree murder. All three men now face death by lethal injection. And if the prosecutors were successful, they would be the first defendants to be executed in the state since 1939. Experts estimated that it would cost the state up to $3 million to convict, incarcerate, and execute each defendant. But the state was ready to foot the bill. While the grand jury proceedings themselves were sealed, newspapers were still able to report on the details contained in the indictments. And this is the story that the prosecution went with. That 2 days before the murder, Tony Puff met with Ken Johnson and was offered $10,000 to kill Sharon Johnson. The next day, Tony met with Jason Carroll at the Meineke Muffler to solicit him. The following evening, Jason and Tony met again at the Meineke and drove to the Mall of New Hampshire together. They forced Sharon to drive with them in her own car to the construction site in Bedford, where Jason stabbed her, Tony strangled her, and then molested her after she was dead. That's it. The information was bare bones, but enough to horrify any citizen following the case. Once the grand jury indicted Jason, Karen seemed to become increasingly frantic, unsure of how to save her son now that she had helped him dig himself in so deep, and now that it seemed that Lammy didn't need her anymore. Shortly after the grand jury proceedings, Karen called Sharon Johnson's brother, Ken Eaton. She had seen an interview in the local news in which Ken Eaton said that he didn't believe that all three defendants should get the death penalty, and she was really grateful to hear that. Karen told Ken Eaton that her son was full of remorse for getting roped into everything, that he had felt threatened into participating in the murder, and that he was essentially a good kid who wasn't like Ken Johnson or even like Tony. Jason didn't deserve to die.
Sergeant Lammy wasn't just close with Jason's parents. He had also built a close bond with Sharon Johnson's family, including her brother Ken Eaton and his wife Diane. Lammy had gained the trust of not just Melanie, Sharon's daughter, but of Lisa Johnson too, the mother of Tony's child and Ken Johnson's adopted daughter. That's why in late January 1990, around the time the grand jury was being seated, Lisa turned over a letter to Sergeant Lammy that Tony had written to her. Here's what it said. "I'm in here because I lied about this to implicate myself and put myself in this situation. I'm real sorry that I lied about this whole thing. But I am in here and there is nothing I can do about it now. When I went down there to talk to your dad, I was only thinking to set up for the police, not for me. I really didn't know what was going on. I really didn't know what this was about. I just was asked to set your dad up to confess. I am real sorry that I did try it. At the time, they were giving me a perfect opportunity, so I took them because I had nothing else at the time. But most of all, I didn't think about the consequences for lying, and I'm real sorry that I didn't think before acting. I would be here if I thought about them. But I suppose the truth will come out in the end. If you are wondering, I didn't have anything to do with it. If your dad did have anything to do with this, I'm not saying he did, but just that if he did, I hope and pray that he will say that I wasn't involved when I wasn't. They are trying to take back my statement that I made because it was a lie, and my aunt and uncle are my witnesses. But anyway, don't think I don't care about you or my son because I do. Whether you believe that or not, you don't know the whole story. I was told not to call you or write to you by the state police. That's why you haven't heard from me. But thank you for the pictures, and please send more if you would. How is Kevin doing? Well, I hope. I wish I could be there to watch him grow, and I am sorry I am not." It won't be the first or the last time that Tony says he had nothing to do with the murder to his friends and family. But of note here is that he seems to be saying he didn't even move the car. Because if he had moved the car, he likely wouldn't question whether or not Ken was guilty. Tony says he was asked to set up Ken, and he went along with it because the police were offering him something. What exactly we're not sure of, but he was in a place where he needed the police's help. If Sergeant Lammy or others made Tony any promises having to do with this fairly petty criminal record, we don't know. Nothing like that is in the files that we have. But remember, we only have Jason's files, not Tony's. But that's not for lack of trying. Tony's lawyer did try to find his trial transcripts and defense file for us. But given that it's been 30 long years since the trial, attorney Mark Sisti didn't think he would have held on to him for that long. That's right, Mark Sisti, the well-known attorney that Karen Carroll had first thought of retaining for Jason, ended up representing Tony.
Actually, it was a case that came to us because the local district court clerk called us and asked us if we would agree to take the case on an assigned basis. My partner and I at the time, Paul Toomey, my law partner, and I had been doing homicide cases exclusively for the public defender office from 1982 to 1988. We started our own firm in 1988. We had both been public defenders together since 1979. So we had done, probably by that time, we had handled over 100 murder cases. So when they had three co-defendants, they were attempting to find qualified individuals to take the case. The public defender's office took Johnson himself, the husband of the deceased. I believe Cliff Kinghorn and Steve Maynard were assigned to Jason's case, and Paul Toomey and I were assigned to Tony's case. We also brought in Alan Cronheim from our Portsmouth office to concentrate entirely on the death penalty aspect.
Sisti might have been a very experienced defense attorney by this time, but this case was unlike most other murder cases.
We had been involved in a death penalty case early in the 1980s. It resulted in an acquittal. There hadn't been another death penalty case charged in New Hampshire until this one. So it drew a lot of attention. It was covered, you know extensively. And the subject matter was disturbing, I suppose.
It was true that the nature of the case was horrific. A pregnant woman murdered in cold blood, a seeming conspiracy of three men to lure her to her death and leave her body behind. And yet, the fact that this was a death penalty case left Sisti scratching his head.
You know, I have to be frank with you on this. I think the proper procedures for determining whether it should have been a death penalty case probably were not fully complied with. I think what happened is that the chief investigator for the state police was hell-bent on bringing it as a death penalty case. The chief investigator on the case certainly was pushing extremely hard for this to be a death penalty case. It was almost as though it was a personal situation. That's the way we sensed it. I think it was something that may have moved this particular investigator to the point where for some reason he brought it to the top of the heap. I just can't understand it to this day, because I had been on several cases that were just as egregious. They weren't brought as death penalty cases. That could have qualified under the statute. This, for some reason, came to the top, and again, to this day, I don't know why. And the only factor that I could perceive was the lead investigator.
Sisti was no stranger to the man leading this investigation, Sergeant Lammy.
Oh, Lammy, sure. What do you want to know about Lammy? Listen, let me put it to you this way, okay? I told you at the beginning of the interview that all I worked on for 6 years as a public defender, six of my 10 years there, was homicide defense. I was on the homicide defense project. And every time we would get a case, if the case file came in with his name on it, we would celebrate. We knew, okay, that something was going to go wrong, okay? He was a very dangerous, I'm going to say two things about him that may sound like they're contradictory. He was a genius, and he had great instinct, okay? The only problem is he didn't play by the rules, you know? Where if you really wanted to find out something, he could find out. He could probably figure it out. The only problem is that the way he got there is all illegal and unconstitutional, you know?
So Lammy was the lead investigator that Sisti believed, for some personal reason, was pushing for the death penalty in this case. Which meant the very first order of business for the defense attorneys became attacking the death penalty statute itself. At the time the charges were brought, the New Hampshire death penalty statute had a flaw in it. Under the statute, only a seated jury could sentence someone to death, not a judge. That meant if the defendant waived his right to a trial and instead pleaded guilty before a judge, there would be no way for a judge to sentence him or her to death. Might sound like a loophole until you look at it this way. The statute forced the defendant to waive his or her right to a jury trial in order to avoid the death penalty. And that was unconstitutional. Defense counsel for all three of the men challenged the statute, arguing that New Hampshire's death penalty was not enforceable because the law violated the defendant's state and federal rights to trial by jury, against self-incrimination, to equal protection of the law, and to due process of law. A hearing was held in the matter in December of 1990, and a decision was issued in July of 1991. Superior Court Judge Walter Murphy ruled the defense was right. The statute was unconstitutional, which meant the state could not pursue the death penalty against any of the three defendants. This legal flaw, by the way, was corrected with the passage of a new statute in January of 1991, but the new law wasn't retroactive and couldn't be applied to these charges. Jason, Tony, and Ken managed to escape the risk of the death penalty thanks to their tenacious attorneys, but now they still had to face their trials and could still end up spending the rest of their lives in prison. The three men were to be tried separately, and the defense attorneys had a game plan.
The critical strategy for us was the proper placement of where we would be in the trial order. There was some coordination among the parties as to who should go first. And we decided that Johnson himself should go first.
The strategy was simple. Both Jason and Tony stood by their innocence, and their attorneys would challenge their confessions as being coerced. And whether or not their confessions would be admissible in court, both of them would assert their Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate themselves. In other words, neither Tony or Jason would testify against each other or against Ken.
And without our clients, Johnson's case would have been extremely strong. if our clients were not involved. The second case, we wanted to go second. Once Johnson, we had figured, would be acquitted or nolprost, which would eliminate Johnson from testifying in Puff's case. And Carol would have been pending, separate and apart from Puff, which would eliminate him as a witness and bar any of his statements from being introduced at Puff's trial, which gave us a much, much stronger position.
They were right, and they left the prosecutors in a dilemma. How would they convict Ken Johnson if neither Jason or Tony testified against Ken?
Without Jason Carroll testifying, mm-hmm. which he did not, he refused to do. Jason, as you know, I mean, the problem with his case is his mother pushing a confession out of him. My client, Tony Puff, actually confessed to Roland Lamley, the chief investigator. Without those two individuals testifying, Johnson's case stood alone. There was no corroborating evidence other than the confessions and statements of the co-defendants. I mean, I'm just saying, without witnesses, without so-called eyewitnesses or perpetrators to corroborate that theory, I mean, then the case is dead in the water.
This was indeed a big problem. The state had no evidence against Ken except for these confessions. Maybe, prosecutors theorized, they could still introduce the confessions themselves as evidence, even if Tony and Jason did not testify against Ken. It turned out, though, that they couldn't. After researching the question, the state decided the confessions weren't admissible without the confessees testifying in person. Without basically any evidence with which to try Ken, the state had a couple of options. The first was to try Ken anyway and risk his acquittal, which meant double jeopardy would attach. If acquitted, Ken could not be tried again on the same charge in case they found new evidence in the future. Their other option was one that they were loath to even consider, to drop the charges against Ken for now, and save the chance to try him again later down the road. Which is what they did. On October 4th, 1991, Ken Johnson walked out of prison, all charges dropped. Tony and Jason now face the charges alone.
Tony's trial began the next month, in November of 1991. Though Jason wasn't testifying against Tony, the judge allowed Jason's taped confessions into evidence. The court also allowed Tony's confession in. This meant it would fall to the jury to decide whether or not the confession was coerced. Ironically, and maybe this is a hindsight view, Tony's confession may have actually worked in Tony's favor.
The strength of our case in a lot of ways had to do with his confession. Even though he confessed to a killing, he also denied it the next day. And the internal factual components of his confession were actually impossible. We also had an alibi that he was in Massachusetts that day, cleaning, I think at a Burger King, the vents with a company that cleans, you know, exhaust vents. So he was out of state and not in the vehicle as he confessed to. It's a confession, but it's kind of worthless. I mean, it blew up on them.
Jason may not have testified against Tony, and Tony's own confession may have been riddled with impossibilities, but the state was able to wrangle up two witnesses who said they saw Tony with Sharon on the night of the murder at the Mall of New Hampshire. The problem for the state was that in the days after the murder, these very same witnesses reported seeing Sharon that night, but had said that she was alone. Tony's lawyers were able to dispense with these witnesses based upon their own previous statements. The only other possible evidence left the state could have presented were the dozens of people that Sergeant Lamy had interviewed who told him that Tony had come into a lot of money that summer or that he'd bragged about killing someone. Tony's attorneys, however, were ready for it.
It was a tough case, and we had to go to North Carolina and do some investigation down there because there were some claims that some admissions were made down there. And when we finally got down there, the guys basically said, it's bullshit, we didn't admit anything to anybody. I mean, it was the same investigator you know, coming in with these false claims with false witnesses and stuff. I went down with an investigator to North Carolina. We did our own interviews with these people, and they basically, we sat across the table from them, and the first thing they wanted to make sure is that we weren't cops, because the last time they talked about the case, these cops were pushing them around and threatening them and all this other stuff, okay? And, you know, it was something like out of the 50s or something, you know? It was wild. Yeah, and it was like backwoodsy kind of people. They weren't sophisticated, you know? They were the kind of people that cops can take advantage of. And I guess that's the best way I could put it, you know? It's like Jason Carroll and Tony Puff were the kind of people they could push around. They were kids, you know?
Things were already not going great for the prosecution. And then Sergeant Lammy managed to make them worse.
During our case, he broke sequestration. I cross-examined him, I think, on a Wednesday for about 3 or 4 hours. And we find out, and then his partner was supposed to come on a Thursday, I think, or a Friday. I forget, something like that. And they're under sequestration orders not to talk about the case, not to discuss anything that goes on in court, the whole thing, okay. As soon as I finish my cross-examination with him, he calls his partner, and he starts talking about everything I was asking him and all the answers he was giving, okay.
The partner in question that Sisti is referring to is a name you're very familiar with, Sergeant Neil Scott.
Now, his partner, unlike him, was a stand-up, super ethical guy, okay. So he calls the Attorney General's office and basically rats on his own partner, says, look, I can't do this. I mean, the guy calls me up, he's out of control. He's telling me stuff. He's telling me everything. And the AGs then have to go to the judge and say that Lammy broke the sequestration. So I got him held, I got Lammy held in contempt. And during the trial, got an instruction to the jury that Lammy was in contempt, that he defied a direct court order. You're to take that into consideration with regard to his reliability and all this other stuff. I mean, it was powerful stuff. I mean, he blew himself up, you know.
According to what Sergeant Lammy told the chief prosecutor, Sergeant Scott had called to ask him how things were going in court, and Lammy told him to make sure and review the confession statements and other details of the case before testifying. It didn't really matter what he told him, though. What mattered was that Lammy broke the sequestration order. When the court was informed by the prosecutors of what had happened, he dismissed the jury for the day and called Lammy and Scott to testify individually before him. This presented another dilemma. Sergeant Lammy could invoke his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself and refuse to testify, but then the day and a half worth of testimony he'd already given against Tony would also be stricken from the record. Lammy didn't invoke the Fifth, though, and admitted to the judge that he'd spoken to Sergeant Scott without realizing he was breaking the order. Lammy was held in contempt, and once the defense began to present its case, the jury was informed of what Lammy had done.
The defense's case was short and sweet, lasting only a couple of days, in which Tony's attorneys first called a New Hampshire State Police Lab expert. The expert told the jury that Tony's fingerprints and blood were nowhere to be found on any of the evidence. A second forensic expert then testified that no trace evidence, soil, hair, or fibers, connected Tony to the crime or the crime scene. Tony's aunt and uncle, the Gagnons, next testified about the night that they were summoned to the police station and told by Sergeant Lammy to convince Tony to cooperate. They testified that when they first saw Tony, his eyes were bloodshot and he was exhausted. They watched as Sergeant Lammy and Tony screamed and exchanged profanities at each other. And when Lammy left the room, Tony repeated for 10 minutes, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it." Lammy returned to the room with another man, they didn't know who it was, who said that they would now be booking Tony on capital murder charges and seeking the death penalty. That was when the Gagnons testified that Tony whispered to his aunt and uncle that he was just going to tell the police what they wanted to hear to get them off his back. The defense also presented a witness from the mall who had seen a woman that resembled Sharon holding hands with a man with a big, black, bushy beard. Yes, the same beard that Jason worked into his confessions. A beard that none of the three defendants ever had. Then there was this. The general manager of high-tech fire prevention himself testified that Tony had been at work on the night of the murder from 10 p.m. until nearly 5 a.m. The trial lasted 2 weeks, and in closing arguments, attorney Mark Sisti focused on the lack of any physical or forensic evidence tying Tony to the murder. He pointed to Ken's suspicious behavior, and he called out the conduct of Sergeant Lammy, calling him a liar and saying that he had, quote, shamed police work. After about a day of deliberation, the jury delivered its verdict. Not guilty on all charges. Tony Puff had been acquitted.
I know that as soon as Tony Puff was acquitted, he got a bus ticket out of New Hampshire. We were able to have him move very quickly to North Carolina. So he was out of sight and out of mind. And they were standing alone with Jason Carroll's case at that point in time.
Next time on Undisclosed. If you have any information related to this or any of the cases we cover, remember you can reach us on our phone line at 410-205-5563. Once again, that's 410-205-5563. As always, a big thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and of course to Mithil Thelhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant Jennifer Leahy and her mom, and homicide investigator Sarah Kalin, who spent way too long in a car with me driving around New Hampshire.
So I'm looking at your testimony, and this is the direct examination, which is when Jason's attorneys are talking to you.
Yeah.
And you were explaining that you basically met, you and Leslie were out, and he was cruising on Elm Street, and that's you guys.
Yeah, that's true.
It was in the area of the Meineke Muffler was apparently like a real hot spot.
It was, right over there. Oh, yes. And that across the street where the Market Basket is now.
Yeah.
That whole strip was, you would sit there and
but
you would just.
To be a Demoulas.
Yes.
I remember.
Yes.
It's just the name
you
of
just
the
sit there in your park and you sit on your car and watch the people drive by. And
I just remember my grandma and her like bi-weekly show. We gotta go to Demoulas.
Demoulas, yes.
Are they Maine Coons?
They're Maine Coons, yes. I hate them. Just saying. They leave hair everywhere.
I'll take one for you.
I have two that I love and hate because every single morning it's like, I know one of you vomited somewhere and the other one probably just, like, I don't know why we have one who has such an attitude. Anytime he's upset, he just poops.
I'm sorry. I'll explain all this to you later. I'm not in trouble. Don't worry.
I think this is the most intimidating thing. Right? That mic is like, what is happening here?
So they're doing an interview with me on a case I testified on, a murder trial I testified when I was 18. And they're reopening it, or they're trying to, because honestly, Jason was 100% innocent. He was found guilty.
All right, don't let me interrupt. I'm sorry for showing up at a horrible time.
That's fine. What was I saying here before?
You were talking about Tony.
So you were talking about Tony.
Oh, yeah, so Tony got acquitted. Tony might not have gotten acquitted if Jason had testified against him.
But I'm wondering, I don't know.
So Jason never
Jason
talked to you about,
never mentioned to me about that.
About
no,
why he did or didn't.
No, okay. He didn't.
I would speculate.
But Tony didn't testify against Jason either, did he?
No, he did not.
So I don't know. Okay. Unless Jason just didn't have anything to contribute.
That's kind of my feeling is that he kept saying, I didn't have anything to do with this. And his attorneys might not have even let him. Because if he does testify against this guy, the only thing that lends any credence to his testimony would be if he had.
Absolutely.
And so there's just no reason.
That's what, that's the only thing.
I'll tell you the only reason for him to testify would have been to cut himself a deal.
Yes.
Right.
And so he gave that opportunity up. Possibly because he's like, I'm not going to do it.
But if he was innocent, why would you cut a plea deal if you're innocent? I would never. And you know what? Unfortunately, Jason's living proof now that our justice system sucks.